This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, it feels like ages since we've been on together. Maybe almost like 100 years or so?
Wow, Chris. I agree with you. It's been a long road. That's a wrong show.
That's a wrong show, Matthew.
Yeah, anyway. Chris, we've been on for... This is the 100th episode. Did you get your celebratory ractigino?
Yeah, that's why I was thinking of 100. Not 100 years, 100 episodes that we're doing here. Yes, this is our 100th episode, numbered episode of The Orb. Of course, we do The Orb of Mel as well. So this is actually like 106 or something for us. But we're going to call it episode 100.
Woohoo!
We made it, Matthew. We made it to 100, finally.
Hey, can you tell Morn to keep it down? Goodness. I mean, he's really excited.
Nothing gets him more excited than a big anniversary.
That's
or
so
his
true.
Mother's birthday.
Oh, you should see the presents she gets. I mean, it's like piles and piles of them.
He's really good at rapping, that's for sure.
Yes, yes, he is. Well, it's because Kira helps.
True. All right. Well, yeah, this is our 100th episode, as well as our first show of 2016. We did have a little bit of an extended break here due to things going on during the holidays, as well as work getting back into the year, but we're back now. And for our 100th show, we've decided not to do any sort of big celebration like we do sometimes on other shows, but we're going to focus on the 100th episode of Deep Space Nine to go along with our 100th episode of The Orb. And that's an episode called The Ship.
Chris, I gotta say, right off the bat, it's a tough little ship.
That is a tough little ship. People say the Defiant is a tough little ship. That Jem'Hadar warship, really tough. The entire crew is dead, just pulverized. The ship crashes on the planet with no one in control, and still it's intact.
That's the very intact definition. But yeah, they're able to pull the entire thing out and bring it back to Starfleet. I mean,
that's right.
Whoever builds these Jem'Hadar ships, you know, I want to give them a medal or something, because it's an incredible feat of engineering that you could crash out of space onto a planet into the side of a rocky hill, and the ship is still fine.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Well, maybe they will get a medal, and maybe they'll just add it to their collection, like Jadzia.
This is true. I mean, although, you know, you don't really get a lot of Jem'Hadar living that long, so I would think their medal count is pretty small.
Probably. And they could do their medals where, like, they're filled with Ketracel White, so they could just, you know...
Their special white, like Pineapple Express.
Right, like... In event of emergency, crack the metal open, suck the Ketracel White out.
I love it. Oh, that's why aren't we writing for Deep Space Nine, Chris? I don't get it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That would be perfect.
I need to get in touch with some of the authors and get them to add that to the novelverse canon. So
that'd be awesome, right? So maybe what, David R. George III?
Yeah, he writes a lot of DS9. Exactly. Him or you know, David Matt can add it in one of those Section 31 books. You know, maybe Bashir has some contacts with Jim Hadar these days. So yeah, that would be fantastic.
Do you think on Jim Hadar ships along the corridor, there's like a tube of Ketracel White behind a glass door that says, like, in event of emergency, break the glass, and you break it open and pop that right in?
You know, I think they wish that was the case, although we know from an episode later on during the season 6 arc that, no, it's actually kept in that thing that's held by the Vorta, and they control the Ketracel White. So, yes, they would love to just have the hose there that says break in case of emergency, but no, it's clamped down in the Vorta's quarters.
I think that's called the Ark of White, isn't it?
It is. It's not as impressive, obviously, as the Ark of the Covenant, and not something that Indiana Jones cares about.
This is true. Okay, let's talk about the episode at hand here, the ship. This is an episode, I don't know if all Niners feel this way or not, but maybe not diehard Niners, but Star Trek fans watching DS9, I feel like this is one of those episodes that kind of gets lost in the mix, but it's also an important episode. When you think back at all the episodes of DS9, does this one stand out to you, or is this one of the ones where you have to kind of remember, oh yeah, there's that episode where they found the ship crashed on the planet and they had the standoff with the Vorta?
Actually, this one does stand out to me. And I think one of the reasons is because this is a bottle episode, and yet parts of it are filmed in an actual outdoor location.
Yeah.
And so that is always a standout there in Deep Space Nine, because that doesn't happen a lot. You know, it's very infrequent that you get that.
Yeah, bright light on daylight on Deep Space Nine is very unusual.
Yeah, it's almost a... You remember in The Dark Knight Rises where Batman is out in the daylight fighting Bane, and how weird that is to see Batman mm-hmm. out in the light? It's kind of the same way when you see Deep Space Nine characters in the light.
Are you saying Sisko is Batman?
Sisko could be Batman. That would be awesome. Batman emissary. I'm Batman. Actually, though, instead of saying that, he's just, I'm the Sisko.
I'm Sisko. Yeah, exactly.
And he could do it, too, because, I mean...
He could.
Yeah, right? It would be awesome.
He could pull it off. Okay, yeah, that's a good point. It does stand out just because of the aesthetics of the episode, for sure.
And I have to say, too, when there's... I noticed this watching it today for the first time, I think, really... I have to, those uniforms really do look more like pajamas in the daylight than they do when they're surrounded by the darkness of, you know, the space station or in the Enterprise or something. I mean, it really does look like a bunch of people just walking around as if they just got out of bed and they're in their footy pajamas.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because we aren't into the war uniforms yet. We're still in the little jumpsuits.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and... You know, even in the war ones, Sisko's usually the only one that has the jacket. And so, but yeah, it is very funny when you're like, oh, these actual uniforms look kind of silly in the daylight, you know?
Well, you know, the crew was happy that they were in these jumpsuits and not the war uniforms on this planet, though, or they would have really died of heat stroke.
Oh, I can't imagine how hot those uniforms would have been. And then they did that in the 6th season, where they were outdoors there in California and in the hot sun. And I can't even fathom what that's like, being in a wool jumpsuit
in
the summer.
Makes you wonder what's going on in the minds of those at the Starfleet School of Fashion when they came up with that design.
How do we make the belt buckle bigger? That's what's going on.
It's like when George Costanza wanted to put the Yankees, or did put the Yankees, in cotton so the uniforms could breathe.
Can you imagine all the Starfleet officers walking around in like linen uniforms?
All right. Okay. Well, let's get serious for a minute and remember that one very important thing about this story is that this is where they get the ship that they use later on during the war to go destroy the Ketracel White facility. It's really, really important, both the intelligence that they get from taking the ship apart, you know, and looking at all the systems, that's really important for the war effort. And then the fact that they actually have the ship so they can sneak behind enemy lines is also really, really important. And it's in this episode that they actually get their hands on the ship in a very unexpected manner.
Well, it reminds me of, obviously, Star Wars and Episode 6, where they have the stolen Imperial shuttle, the shuttle Tidarian.
Oh, right.
You know, and it's the same kind of principle. They use the stolen shuttle and the stolen ship to infiltrate later on. And I love that it wasn't a forgotten storyline. You know, you had to have somebody writing that episode and be like, wait, I've got it. We can use the ship that we used in that episode. Well, it was a really original title then, The Ship, and we can make this work. And so it was one of those neat things where Deep Space Nine, it just remembered itself, you know? And yeah. I think that's what really works about this episode for me, is that they're doing a lot of great character things here along with finding the ship. I mean, it's important finding the ship, but this episode seems to be kind of more about all that's going on with the characters as they're kind of in there under pressure, you know. And I won't sing any Queen for you with David Bowie, but I'm thinking about that as we were talking before the orb, on the other side of the orb with, you know, him just having passed. And I think that makes for a really interesting episode, you know, to get into these characters. I mean, we're in season 5, very beginning here, so.
Well, it also holds true to Deep Space Nine that in the face of conflict, it's always about the characters, which we always talk about when people say DS9 was too dark. It was the war show. It did not uphold the ideals of Gene Roddenberry because of all the conflict. Well, it really did, because the conflict is just the backdrop. And it's the characters that are at the forefront and how they react to their situations. And before we leave the fact that they get the ship here, you know, Sisko says essentially that this is the find of the decade. I thought it was interesting that he chose 10 years, though, because when he said that, I'm thinking like, okay, well, what else did they discover? What would be right up there with getting this ship in the past 10 years? But it is the find of the decade, apparently, for Starfleet.
I would have thought finding the wormhole so that you could get to the Gamma Quadrant was more than the find of the decade.
I think so.
Apparently, he's been reading Picard's, like, archaeology journals, and this happened to be something that he would equate with the find of the decade.
I think that Troy would say that the find of the decade was Barclay's holodeck program, although it wasn't a pleasant find.
Not a pleasant find for anyone but Barclay.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and it wasn't even pleasant for Barclay either, because he didn't want people to know he was doing that.
Oh, that's just awful. Chris, this is a Deep Space Nine show. Let's focus.
But yeah, I think you're right. Finding the wormhole should trump finding this one ship, because the war isn't really happening yet. It's not the full-blown Dominion War that we think of. And so at this point, and like you said, later on DS9 remembers itself, they're not really setting something up here like, let's find a ship so we can use it to go behind enemy lines. That just happens to be a convenience later.
I have a quick question for you. You know, Sisko, at the very end, he says to Dax that these people died on an unknown planet 50,000 light years from home. And I was thinking to myself, wow, they're basically like almost as far as Voyager was for so much of their journey. But, you know, they get to skip so much because of the distance with the wormhole. And just what a cool storytelling device that is, and really opened up. And, you know, when we talk about this find of the decade, I think that was what was neat about this episode, is it's very Star Trek-y. You know, they're surveying a planet. They're looking for a place for mining. And they've sent the crew of Deep Space Nine. So it felt like a very classic TOS, TNG type of episode. But at the same time, it's so Deep Space Nine. And they've really found the way to work in so many different aspects of Star Trek into the show by this point, that it's really cool that you can have all of those playing together, and that they actually play really well together.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up TOS, because when they say at the beginning that they're looking for a place to do mining, that's exactly what I thought of, because that's just the kind of thing that Kirk's Enterprise would be visiting a planet for, would be to figure out if they could mine there.
Unfortunately, there were no Horta in this episode.
That's true. No Horta. Otherwise, the Horta could have just burned a hole right through the ship and gotten right
Oh, they could have gotten that ship out quick. I mean, made. Right. I mean, that would have been like a five-minute eating session for them.
Exactly. Another thing that was Star Trek-y about it is how they called back to some familiar alien races in the Federation, specifically the Benzites. But what I love about how they handled the Benzite in this episode is that in true DS9 fashion, they said, okay, we're going to use a Benzite, but you know that breathing apparatus thing they have to wear? Forget about that. That's just technobabble. We're not going to have our actor wear that. We're just going to have them be a normal person.
Well, I mean, Dr. Bashir is a genius, so maybe he had solved the Benzite breathing problem, so they didn't need, you know, this apparatus where it was really hard to understand what they're talking about, like Kylo Ren. It's just, you know, I noticed that as well, and I was thinking, interesting way of saving some money there, because, you know, dry ice is so expensive.
That's true. Maybe he used the venom of some Regalian flea spiders to allow the Benzite to breathe without the apparatus.
Again, Bashir, the genius. I mean, I could totally see him solving this problem in his spare time. And, you know, this is before we know that he is a genius, that, you know, he's been genetically enhanced.
Right.
So this was just one of his many breakthroughs that took him actually 5 minutes to figure out, but he made it seem like it took him 15 years.
Yeah. And in fact, in this episode, he says he's the opposite of a genius. He says he's an idiot, and Quark agrees.
Well, you know, anytime you join forces with Quark and ask him for something, you've got to suspect there's going to be some sort of ulterior motive. So I kind of think that is his, you know, come on, Bashir. You've been hanging out with Garrick too long for this to happen.
Well, let's move on and talk about the Vorta in this episode, Keelana, a little bit. I feel like she's a different kind of Vorta than we've seen before. But then again, I'm not sure. I feel that way largely because of the way she presents herself, the intonations she uses when she speaks. She reminds me a lot of Kim Cattrall as Valeris in Star Trek VI. But at the same time, she is very deceptive, which we expect from the Vorta. In that sense, she reminds me a lot of Weyoun. What did you think about Keelana? Does she feel different to you? Does she feel the same, somewhere in between?
It was an interesting thing. I like that you mentioned Valeris, because there is something in the way that Kim Cattrall played her that I did kind of feel here from Caitlin Hopkins' portrayal of Keelana. And there's this strange thing going on the first time that she meets Sisko. You know, she's kind of pretending to be this innocent, you know, like this is her first mission. And it's this weird kind of like, kind of creepy sexuality she's playing off of him with. And it just, the whole thing comes off as just uber creepy. And obviously nothing that is it's not fooling Sisko. You know, he's too straightforward for that. And I don't even think this would have fooled Kirk. So she's definitely not doing any of that well in this episode. She really misjudges the person that she's up against. And I think probably that's the most interesting part of this, is her thinking she can play him easily and having no idea who she's up against, because, you know, Sisko, he's no pushover. In this guy, he punched Q. I think he can figure out that you're just a liar and deceptive little thief.
Not only Q, but remember, he's constantly having to go head-to-head with Dukat, and Keelana is in no way in the same league as Dukat in terms of being deceptive, in terms of negotiating, getting her way, playing Sisko.
And she's no Weyoun, so, I mean, let's just be honest.
Maybe she was also thrown off of her game a bit because she had seen photos of Sisko, but he was much more striking in person than she was expecting.
I tend to agree. You know, once they you know, shaved the head and gave him the goatee, this was a good looking man. Avery Brooks was really pulling this role off at that point, and
he was. He really was.
Yeah, it's an interesting portrayal, and I liked it because it added some nuance to the Vorta, that they all kind of have their own way of trying to deal with a situation. And, you know, so we've seen a couple of female Vorta at this point, and then we'll see a few male Vorta, and they all have their own personalities. It's very interesting. I mean, let's be honest, too, Iggy Pop played a Vorta, and a very interesting Vorta at that, so.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all deceptive, but they all have their own unique characteristics. You know, we got the very slimy Vorta in Rocks and Shoals, who was ready to just turn over his soldiers to save himself.
Yeah, that guy was just, oh, he was awful. Like, you really wanted him to die.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, this is great because this is how any real race of people would be, right? Everyone's different. You need to have unique personalities, and there can be a uniting thread. And that's what we see. I'm not going to say we don't see it at all. And certainly in DS9, we get more of it. But like overall, Klingons in Star Trek tend to have the same approach. In TNG, anyway, they seem to have the same approach to things, right? And there aren't very many unique personalities that we see. And here with the Vorta, we do see a lot more unique personalities. You know, with Klingons, we get, you know, Gowron's unique. Martok is, of course, unique. But a lot of the other Klingons that we see appear in one episode here, one episode there, tend to be very similar. With the Vorta, with Kelana and others, we get very different types of characters.
It's almost as though they were able to take the work that they had done with the Cardassians and not having them all be the same, and they really started to transfer that to different races. Obviously, we meet tons of different types of Bajorans, and, you know, again, moving towards the Vorta, each time one of them was on, except for Weyoun, they were very different. And then luckily we got Weyoun back because it's Jeffrey Combs and he's everywhere. And I think he just became the most popular and they enjoyed bringing him back. But I loved that each time we saw a Vorta for a while, they were this kind of different type of character. And, you know, I think that keeps the crew off their game as well, not knowing necessarily what to expect either. You know, when you keep dealing with the same Vorta all the time, you know what to expect. But here, Sisko coming into this, he just has his reserve of, is there any way I could trust this person at all? And I think the way that she handles it at the very beginning, it puts him off completely from trusting anything she's going to say. She just, as she said, she completely mishandles the situation from the beginning and puts no faith in herself out towards Sisko. So,
did she seem a bit like a con artist to you? Because Caitlin Hopkins actually played a con artist elsewhere in Star Trek. Do you recognize her? She was Dala in Live Fast and Prosper on Voyager, posing as Janeway.
Oh my gosh, that's right. I totally forgot.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, the characters are they're quite different, but at the same time, some of the, you know, kind of con artist negotiation tactics that you see Dala using, you can see those in Kelana as well.
No, I think that's really interesting. And the way that she does approach it is kind of like that slicked used car salesman, like just swarmy. You know, that's immediately what you feel from the character. That she's trying to find a way to imbibe the conversation with trust. And all she brings to the conversation is complete mistrust on Sisko's part because he's immediately put off by everything that she's doing. And what I liked about it is that it made for a nice, you know, Star Trek thing of the way different races try to work together, and it's just not very successful here. You know, she's not reading any of the signals immediately saying, oh, reverse course, danger, Will Robinson. None of that.
I'm just, I'm just picturing her arms flapping around.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger, Ben Sisko. Danger, Ben Sisko. Yeah, you know, mistrust is a big topic here because I feel like this episode, in a way, is mistrust in a microcosm. In any conflict, you have two sides that are really mistrusting one another. They may have a difference in ideology, but they could still work together. They could still have at least a Cold War like we had, like the Americans had with the Soviets, instead of having an open conflict. And when you look at the Federation-Dominion War, there's obviously a great deal of mistrust there between them. And at the end of this episode, the Founder is dead. That's what she wanted from the ship. She just wanted the Founder that was still aboard the ship. She didn't care about the ship. And all Sisko wanted was the ship. He didn't even know that there was a Founder on there initially. And they couldn't come to this simple agreement as two people on this deserted planet. So what does that say about the overall storyline of the Federation Dominion in the first place? You've got Sisko, you've got Keelana here representing both sides.
I understood, you know, what Sisko was feeling, in that if we had just trusted each other, we could have avoided all of this. And it's a noble sentiment. And yet, trust is something that is earned. And, you know, up to this point, the Dominion hasn't really given Sisko, in his experience, any room to be able to trust them. It's very much the whole idea, trust but verify. And there's not a lot of wiggle room with what's going on here. You know, again, with the way that this Vorta has approached everything, it's been something that puts Sisko off immediately for mistrust of her, because he can tell that she's lying from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it's, watching the episode again, I thought it was a little bit funny that the crew can't piece together quicker what's on the ship that would make the Jem'Hadar not attack.
Yeah, you would think that they would know that the loyalty that the Vorta have and the Jem'Hadar have to the Founders, that, well, maybe there's a Founder somewhere. Maybe if Odo had been with them, Odo would have somehow sensed that there was a changeling aboard.
Well, yeah, I was thinking that, and, you know, and I'm sure they didn't think about it being a Founder, because I'm sure in their minds, if there was one here, they've seen what one is capable of and could have easily taken them all out instantaneously if it wanted to, just because they're so quick.
Yeah.
So I guess that didn't even, you know, strike their minds. There might be a sick changeling on board. But on the actual trust issue, I think it spoke interestingly, and I love watching Deep Space Nine these days, because I feel like it's just so relevant as it ever was. And this idea of mistrust between, you know, big nations and nation states. And then, of course, I think to like terrorist organizations and everything like that. And the idea of, it would be great if we could just find a way to trust each other. The hard thing is getting there, because we also know the danger of mistrust and placing our trust in somebody who doesn't deserve it. And all of that together, I was really moved by the conversation at the very end of the show with Dax and Sisko. And I was actually welling up a little bit, because of what they're talking about is so heartbreaking, and that it doesn't matter who dies and on which side, it should always be sad. And I love that, you know, Jen Zia says, well, maybe it should never be easy. And the moment it starts to get easy is when we really have to be like, oh, we're way past okay, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of those barometers of saying, as long as we're never just saying, oh, well, it was worth it, without remorse or intense sadness over the loss of life and the desire to try and find a way to move forward, you know, then we have issues.
Yeah.
But I love it. It's a really moving episode.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, the conversation at the end is really a key to that. but also things that happened on the ship as well, with O'Brien, with Munoz. Worf is interesting as well, both during the episode and at the end. I mean, let's talk about O'Brien and Munoz a little bit, because Munoz is a character who we've seen before. We saw him in Starship Down. We saw him in Hard Time. And the writers were trying to create sort of a brotherhood of the engineers on the show to show that the engineering team, they were together. And we've talked before many times about how O'Brien, he's not an officer. He's not a commissioned officer. He's just a chief. But yet he knows more than most officers do. He has more experience. And therefore, many people who outrank him, even low-level commissioned officers, but also high-ranking officers, respect him very much because of his knowledge. And I think that that's true in real life in the military as well. At least that's what I've been told by people who have served in the military and how they feel about those officers or those individuals who aren't commissioned. But at any rate, we see that here where Munoz is kind of, he's picking on O'Brien, but at the same time, he's respectful of O'Brien as someone who is more knowledgeable and is a mentor to him. And this is set up to be an episode where there's a great loss for O'Brien. And in many respects, this is a character episode for O'Brien, although not exclusively. There's a lot of other stuff going on. But my question would be, even though they made this attempt to create a brotherhood of engineers, and even though we saw Munoz in the past and other episodes, did it work for you in terms of tugging on your emotions that this was a great loss for O'Brien? Did you have that connection between him and Munoz, or him and the engineering team? Or did it feel like it was just sort of happening, kind of out of the blue, suddenly there's this connection?
I think it works well enough. I mean, it's not perfect, obviously, but I think it works well enough. I love the banter back and forth. I think they do a good job with that. They create enough of a connection so that I do feel something when they're gone. And I think the connection that I feel was more interesting in respect to O'Brien and Worf and how it impacts their friendship. So that when you got to the end scene, I thought that that was a kind of a choke-up moment as well, as O'Brien is sitting there and Worf realizes he's kind of been a jerk in how he's handled O'Brien in this situation. And he comes in so respectfully and shares something, you know, personal for him and very Klingon, which is Worf, and finds a way to apply that to what O'Brien is going through to bond them back together. And I think it shows a real maturity, and it also really, what I love about it too, is that it's not just an O'Brien episode, it's a Worf episode, and he's learning something through his relationship with Jadzia. Because as they're walking away, she's like, and maybe we'll talk about the finer points of diplomacy, as, you know, like...
Right.
And so... It's just a small thing, but I think it works well enough. But I don't think it's working quite the way they wanted to, but it's working more on the other side with O'Brien and what it's doing for him and Worf as characters together and separately. So, yeah.
Well, I think those are different things. Like with Worf, it is interesting. Jadzia does really help Worf grow up a lot, right, over the course of their relationship on the show. I did want to ask you what you thought about Worf's initial reaction when he's just saying about Munoz, no, he will not make it. He will not see the light of another day. He was dead the moment he was shot. I mean, even if you feel that way as a Klingon, you're not with Klingons, right? And there was just this complete disconnect between Worf and his crewmates and how he should be reacting to them and how he should treat a human crewmate in Munoz who is suffering as well. And be supportive. You know, they're not Klingons. And Worf seemed very out of touch. But not only did he seem out of touch, but I felt like it was very abrupt. Like, he was even harsher than I would expect Worf to be at this point. It felt a little bit out of character for me in the episode.
I can agree with you. in that sense. I think one of the things that it felt like they were doing in the episode was ratcheting up everybody's frustration level slowly throughout the episode, and that was part of where Worf's frustration was coming out, is that the way he was unfortunately dealing with it was to bring out his frustration on O'Brien, because I think his thought process was, stop focusing on the dude who's about to die and let's focus on the people who are alive so we can get the heck out of here. That's probably Worf's thought process, and the filter was starting to come off the Klingon at that point, you know, as it does with everybody. You know, the same thing happens with Dax later on. She makes a joke and Sisko's had enough. He's like, those jokes aren't helping. You know, like everybody...
not sure if you've noticed, but no one is laughing.
Exactly. Everybody is being kind of pushed to a limit in this episode. And I felt like that was the point where they were starting to show, okay, these characters are starting to have... their limits. And Klingons don't like to be caged, no matter if they've been in Starfleet or not. So I think that probably was having an effect on Worf as well. And he just didn't handle it as well as he should have.
Well, and in that sense, I think the episode works quite well, how they do ratchet up the tension over the course of the episode. And then they have the Jem'Hadar starting to bomb the area, basically not trying to hit the ship, but just trying to rattle the crew. And if you're stuck inside a ship where you can't see what's outside and all you have are two little headsets and, you know, there's no other way to see outside of this ship, it's very sealed, you would feel that way for sure. The part where I also said that those are different things, I think that the ultimate result of this episode is that it works from the O'Brien angle of what the loss of Munoz means to O'Brien as an individual, and also the bonding that you talked about with Worf and O'Brien in that final scene. I think it's a little bit different than the original intention of the episode, which was for Munoz himself to have more impact and for the relationship between Munoz and O'Brien to have more impact on us as the viewers. I think for me, the character just wasn't established enough in the previous two episodes that he appeared in, and the relationship wasn't established enough between O'Brien and his staff in engineering to really make the ultimate goal of this have the impact that they had hoped that it would have.
No, I agree with you, and I think that that's valid. It's difficult on a show like the, you know, it's impressive in the first place that they did have this kind of, it seems like they had this continuity in mind. We all had this character in for a few episodes and hopefully it'll pay off. And like I said, you know, it doesn't pay off perfectly the way I think they intended, but it does well enough for lots of other areas of the show. So I actually like it and I think it works. And I think it makes me enjoy this episode more because of everything that is going on and all the character pieces that are playing together here. And, you know, two, we didn't talk about, but the great scene kind of getting in this personal nature is when Sisko is talking to Jensia, he's talking about, you know, this class that he had at the academy, and she's had it as well, about what it means to be a captain and staying disconnected from your officers. And what I love is that I feel like next to Kirk, and I think Sisko's actually better at it, he allows these people to be a part of his life and know him personally, but at the same time, he does a great job of being okay a lot more with of letting them, you know, do their jobs, and if they need to go into battle or something, that he can let them do that. You know, having them over for dinners and those things to his house. I think, well, not his house, but his quarters, I think is really cool. And it shows a lot about this character. And that conversation, again, on top of everything in this, was pretty impressive. They're doing so much in like 45 minutes in this episode with these characters. Mm-hmm. Just great.
in, as you said earlier, what is essentially a bottle show as well. One other way they ratcheted up the tension, I think, was in real life. Again, you also mentioned earlier about, and we talked about them being in the uniforms out there in the heat, and the ship that they had built into the side of the hill. And one thing, we're not going to discuss it right here, but there were some production issues with this episode, or production challenges. For one thing, it got up to 124 degrees Fahrenheit when they were out there in those uniforms.
That's awful.
Shooting. So what I will point people to is, a couple of years ago, we talked about this episode on The Ready Room. And it's The Ready Room episode number 123. It's called Sitting with the Dead. And go listen to that as well. I had Michael Fisher on, Ben McCormick, who people know from Dork Trek in the past, and John Mills. And one of the things we touched on for quite a while was that production aspect of it. So you can listen to that and supplement this discussion with that. And we talked about O'Brien, Munoz, and Keelan and all that stuff there as well. Well, Matthew, is there anything else that you want to touch on here from this episode?
Well, Chris, just going through this episode, you know, I love when I revisit an episode that I haven't seen in a while, and I'm just struck by how good the work is on Deep Space Nine with the characters and with the writing, and it just sucks me back in, and I want to continue, like, to go to the next episode after this, you know, because it finds a way to remind me what I love so much. And I think that's what makes for a great TV show. My wife and I've been showing her this show. It's a station here on cable in the States is starting to replay this show that I loved called Ed. And I've been showing it to my wife, and I just fall back in love with it as we watch it. And the same thing happens to me with Deep Space Nine or any other good show that I loved, where you watch an episode and you're like, oh man, this show was so good. You know, that's great television, and I love that for so much of Star Trek, that can happen on any of the series. You know, I watch an Enterprise episode, I hit up one of my favorite Voyager episodes, I get in with a great TNG episode, you know, TOS, I even have a few animated series episodes I really like. You know, all of them, they have the way of kind of sucking you in and making you feel like, this is why you love this show. And for me, you know, talking about Deep Space Nine with you for the last few years, I don't even know how many years it's been at this point.
Yeah, I've lost track too. Several.
Yeah, and 100 episodes talking about this along with our Orb of Mail episodes, I continue to find reasons to want to continue talking about the show. And I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, and specifically with this episode, The Ship, I would agree with that too, that when you watch the characters, because of the strength of the writing of this episode and the situations the characters are put in and the dialogue between the characters really makes you realize why you love Deep Space Nine, or at least why I love Deep Space Nine, because it is all about Avery Brooks delivering these messages, these conversations between Sisko and Jadzia, you know, seeing O'Brien be the ordinary guy from the country with gently sloping hills and no mountains, you know? And it really comes out. And you know what's been getting me recently, Matthew, which maybe is weird, but after the teaser of a DS9 episode, just listening to the DS9 theme play, there's something about it that grabs me more than any other Star Trek series, because something about the music and the scenes going around the station, it all comes flooding into me, like just the complexity of the show and the complexity of the characters and how epic the story is, not standalone episodes, but this one epic journey.
Well, this will be funny, Chris, but it reminds me of, you know, I love to joke in the Ready Room of you know, Bilbo running out the door going, and I'm going on an adventure. And that's exactly what Deep Space Nine is. It's this grand, epic, mythic adventure in the Star Trek universe. And I think it's an incredible thing in Star Trek, and it's one that I absolutely love and I adore as a show. I love these characters. You know, this episode, I remember, this is the time period when Kira's pregnant and when her and, mm-hmm. and off screen, you know, Nana and Alexander have a relationship and they created a baby and they had to find a way to work it into the show. And it turned out to be this great, funny, awesome thing. And I think back through all of the seasons of Deep Space Nine and the ways in which the writers really rolled with things, it's just impressive. And the way they created something unique and special in Star Trek that we get to talk about all the time is just fascinating. So, you know, doing this for 100 episodes, I do want to say thanks for listening to us. And I'm excited to continue to talk about it with you, Chris. This honestly just made me... The fact that I can get emotional over an episode I've seen probably at least 10 to 15 times, that's impressive. It's really impressive.
Yeah. Well, I think you just delivered our love letter to Deep Space Nine after 100 episodes of The Orb.
The best is yet to come, babe. Won't it be fine?
All right. Well, let's wrap up this discussion today. So that's The Ship. Really great episode. Go back and watch it if you haven't seen it in a while. And yep, 100 episodes of The Orb under our belt. And we're going to be continuing on. A lot of great stuff coming. And hopefully we're going to try to get the show back to a weekly format here as the year goes on. I'm hoping that my work schedule is going to allow that. But we'll continue to bring it to you as often as we can. At any rate. Well, this has been great. Great celebrating our 100th episode and also talking about The Ship, but it's just one of many, many things we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It would be a lot of fun to be able to MST3K an episode like Arena. Which, who doesn't love poking fun at a rock-throwing Gorn? I mean, come on, you know?
Can you find a rudimentary lathe?
Exactly. I wrote that on the Babel Conference today because Guy Fliegman from Galaxy Quest is the greatest character ever.
Earl Grey.
This 547-meter-long, 32-deck, 502-crew-member.
That's awesome.
To the journey!
Now we go to Once Upon a Time.
Neelix tries to
warp 5.
If they could have kind of told us it's more of a future for us, but we're going to build up to the Star Trek, you know. And Larry's comment back was, well, that would mean that they kind of were planning it out and they knew what they were doing ahead of time.
Buzzing.
That sounds right. Like Larry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I will say, if you want to see what it's really like when someone slices open a tauntaun to get inside to stay warm, like in the real world.
Yeah.
That was the best part of the movie. I'm like, really? Han Solo made it look so easy. This is what happens? This is terrifying.
The 602 Club.
It's about that transformation of getting Oliver to be able to see themselves as something more than vigilantes, but being heroes.
Yeah, and there is a lot of... I like that because there is a lot in the quote unquote, as you're calling it, the island story, which the island now is Hong Kong, as you pointed out.
Yeah,
earlier.
I mean, yeah, it's a little bigger than an island.
Literary Treks.
Dan, are you sure that flavor isn't something like a green liquid voodoo drink?
Oh, man. This.
Because that could be the flavor that we're going for.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find them everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, also Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. Go to the website and stream. Download the MP3 files. We're also on SoundCloud. And I'd also like to point out one special thing we have going right now, which is the 50th anniversary rewatch. This is the first Orb of the new year, the first Orb to drop in 2016, the 50th anniversary year of Star Trek. and Mike Schindler from Commentary Trek Stars came up with a great way for us to celebrate the franchise all year long by putting together a rewatch in which we start with Enterprise and then we go all the way through to Star Trek Beyond. And when we get into the days where, or the years when Voyager, well, TNG and DS9 overlapped and then DS9 and Voyager overlapped, we're actually going to be weaving in and out of the series and we're going to be rewatching it as you would have the first time that it was on. That's going to be kind of fun. Something that I haven't personally ever sat down and really done in that manner. And that show's out right now. It's called From There to Here. You can get it in iTunes. You can get it in other places as an individual show feed, or we're putting them all in the master feed as well, of course. Today, as we record this, it's January 19th, and so today will be day 19, and we're already well into the second season of Enterprise right now. So be sure to check out that show if you haven't listened yet. Really having a lot of fun over there. I'd also like to take a moment here to thank our associate producers here on The Orb, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. They help us get this show out to you guys every time, and they support us through Patreon, which is a wonderful way for listeners to help us keep the network going. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out everything that you need to know. The perks, the ways you can become involved in the network, access to Patron Zone, our exclusive website just for patrons. Lots of great stuff over there. We really do need your help, and we really thank everyone who's helping us right now. All right, Matthew, when you're not researching all the different creative uses for space spider venom, where can people find you?
Oh, man, that is so dangerous, Chris. Well, you can find me tweeting about it on Twitter at MattRushing02. I might take pictures of those spiders on Instagram. Kind of scary. Beware. You can find me there at MRushing and, of course, Trek FM as well. I do the 602 Club, where it's our general geek show here on the network. We don't talk Star Trek, but we talk everything else. So be sure to check that out. It's so much fun. We have a jam-packed year for you already with amazing things coming out. DC, Marvel, Bond, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, big blockbuster movies, old school stuff. I mean, it's all coming at you this year. And in fact, I think Christopher Jones and I are even going to try and get together sometime this year in the 602 Club and talk Battlestar Galacta 1980. That's right. He's dragging me back to the old BSG.
You have to watch the series, Matthew. As I said in the Babel Conference, there is literally a moment where a Cylon is disabled because it walks too close to a microwave oven that is in use.
Well, I mean, that's why at home I have my toaster and my microwave separated. You never know what's going to happen, Chris.
That's right. Toasters don't like microwaves.
Oh, gosh. You can find me on Literary Treks with Dan. We're talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We interview the authors as well of the latest books. We always try to get them on, so... This year, we already have a great lineup for you coming with David R. George III and his latest Deep Space Nine book, as well as the new Voyager book coming out with Kirsten Beyer. We'll be talking to her about Pocket Full of Lies, so great place to check us out. Now, Chris, when you're not stuck in a really long meeting with the creepiest Vorta you've ever been around, where can we find you?
Well, yeah, you can find me doing shows on the network. You can find me in the Babel Conference and elsewhere. Probably the best place to find me if you just want to chat is either the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. If you're not a member, just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field and it'll come right up. It's a closed group, so you need to click join and we'll let you right on in. But I am there talking Star Trek when I have some free moments in my crazy schedule. Also Twitter. I'm more of a Twitter user, actually, because I don't really like Facebook all that much outside of the Babel Conference. And my username on Twitter is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing the Ready Room, which I'm going to get started back up for the new year pretty soon. We do Star Trek news on there, and we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series. You can also find me doing Hyper Channel, which is our new show. And I do have it going daily again on weekdays, Monday to Friday, one story per day, and it's been going daily again now for a month, and I plan to keep that going. It's great to just share my thoughts on some of the stories that are out there each week and each day about the world of Star Trek. Of course, you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. If you'd like to read that, just search for C. Brian Jones, and you should find my articles coming up there. And I do another podcast that's not about Star Trek, believe it or not, called Metropolis on Air. which is about life and entertainment and all kinds of things happening here in the city of Tokyo. And you can find that in iTunes if you like. Also, if you want to send a general message to us here at the Orb or the network, you can do that in a number of ways. You can go to our website, trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and choose the Orb, and then that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. And also, you can find the network on Twitter. TrekFM is the username there.
Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us for the last 100 episodes, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the Orb.
The best is yet to come, babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. The best is yet to come. The best is yet to come. Come the day.